team of brilliant men ever ready at Gregory's command. Research geniuses with microscopes and all kinds of equipment.
I don't know, she said again.
Of course, one time they did contemplate a line of products. You know, trash like spiritually cleansing shampoo and wash-away evil vibrations soap.
I laughed, I couldn't help it.
She smiled.
But we talked him out of that.
He struck some incredibly lucrative deal with a New York designer for all the stock at his resorts and on his boats, and in his jungles.
There we are again. Boats, planes, jungles, doctors, a necklace, a twin brother.
What are you saying?
Look, Rachel, an identical twin is not just a brother. He is a duplicate of the man. And here we have a twin unknown to the world, and not recognized every day of the week, perhaps, because he wears the beard and the locks of the Hasidim. There are things one can do with an identical twin.
She stared at me. She was silent. Then a wince of pain came again.
Look, I have to have water, I said.
I'll bring you some water.
That would be good, cold water. My throat is sore, I can't.
She sank back down. I hurried through the beautiful garden and entered what seemed a grand storage place for fine foods. And sure enough, there were plastic bottles of water galore in the refrigerator. I brought two of these bottles and a lovely crystal glass which I picked off a shelf. I sat down by her and gave her water first. She had covered herself now. She drank. I drank. I really was exhausted. This was not the time to be exhausted, not the time to risk sleeping and letting this body disappear. I drank more of the water, and I wondered what had come out of my body into her. Had it been real seed, or just a semblance? I remembered something about Samuel. Samuel laughing at the Catholic nuns who claimed to be made pregnant by spirits. I remembered that from Strasbourg. And then another lovely memory came. It was all sensory. It had to do with Zervan. And I remember him saying, "You can do it, yes, but it will take away your energy, and you are never to seek a woman without my permission." I couldn't remember the speaker, only the love, and the garden, and the words, and how much it was like this. "It will take away your energy." I had to stay awake.
"What if we're wrong?" she said. "And he had nothing to do with Esther's death. He's a man who uses everything. He used her death, but that doesn't mean—"
"The Rebbe said he killed her. I think he killed her. But there's more at stake. This temple of his, does it preach anything unique or of unique value?"
"Not really.
As I explained, he invented the creed with a computer program. It's the nearest thing to a creedless creed you can imagine." She sighed. She told me there was a dressing gown in the closet. Would I bring it to her? She was feeling a little cold. She said there were robes, too, if I wanted them. I did, but not because I was cold. It was a Persian or Babylonian disinclination to be naked. I found a thick blue robe that fell to the floor, with a tie for the waist, and wrapped myself in this, feeling a little trapped, but it was fine for now, and I needed all my power. I brought the negligee to her. It was gold like so much in the room, and pure silk and full of beaded work rather like that of the dark scarf. She sat up and I helped her put it on, and I buttoned the pearl buttons for her, and then tied the sash. I buttoned the pearls at her wrists. She stared at me.
"I have something else," she said, "that I want you to know."
"Tell me," I said, sitting beside her and taking her hand.
"Gregory called me tonight, right before the plane landed in Miami. He told me you killed Esther. He said you were seen at the scene of the crime. I'd seen your picture in the magazine, but I knew it was a stupid lie. I was about to hang up on him. It's useless, you know, asking him to be reasonable, but then he really went off the deep end. He said you were a ghost. and you needed to take Esther's place in the world. That's how you got in."
"That is trash," I whispered. "He is a smooth-tongued man."
"That's what I thought. I just didn't believe it. But something seemed very certain to me then. You are here because of Esther's death."
"You are, and you're here to kill Gregory. I wish you would promise me, whatever happens, you'll kill him."
"I know it's a terrible thing I'm saying."
"Not to me," I said. "I would like to kill him, but not before this mystery is solved."
"Can you possibly see to Nathan? See that he's safe?"
"I can do that," I said. "But I have grave suspicions on that." "Never mind. Be assured, whatever happens, I will get to the bottom of it. And Gregory will pay with his life."
"Laboratories," she said. "You know he's crazy, Gregory. He believes he is here to save the world. He goes to other countries. He asks for reception by dictators and establishes temples in countries that... And then all this about terrorism." "You know," she said as she lay back down on the pillows, "you can't go wrong killing him. This temple is a racket. It's garbage, and it bleeds people, takes their savings, their fortunes." She closed her eyes and suddenly went still, so still that her eyes half opened and I could see only the whites. "Rachel," I said. "Rachel!" I shook her shoulder.
"I'm alive, Azrael," she said softly, without moving anything but her lips. Her dark brows moved just a little. She didn't open her eyes.
"I'm here," she said. "Will you cover me, Azrael? Even now I'm cold. It's warm, isn't it?"
"The breeze is wondrously warm," I said.
"Open all the windows, then. But cover me."
"What is it? What's the matter with you?" All the windows were open, even the big window doors to my left that looked out on a terrace above the ocean. But I didn't disturb her by saying so. I was suddenly startled. I noticed her arms for the first time, really beheld them beneath the sheer silk.
"Your arms.
I've covered them with bruises. Look what I've done to you."
"That doesn't matter," she said. "That's nothing. It's only one of the drugs thinning the blood. Makes me bruise without feeling it. I loved it, being in your arms. Come here, will you stay with me?" "You know, I suspect I'm going to die right away. I left behind all the drugs that were keeping me going."
I didn't answer her, but I knew she was going to die. Her heartbeat was too slow. Her fingers had a bluish tinge to them. I lay down beside her and covered her with the tapestried draperies that lay all over the bed, what are called throws and lap blankets, though I had not realized it or thought of it. She was nice and warm, and she lay against me.
"I laughed so hard when he said you were a ghost and you killed Esther to get into the world. And yet I knew you weren't a human being. I knew it. You'd vanished from the plane. I knew it. And yet I thought Gregory was so hysterically funny telling me all this black magic, that Esther had to be sacrificed like a lamb so that you could come into the world, and evil beings had done it. He said you'd kill me. He said if I didn't come back he'd alert the police. I don't want him coming in here, disturbing me. I don't want him to."
"I won't let him," I said. "Rest now. I want to think. I want to remember the laboratories and the men in the orange suits. I want to see the great scheme." It was a horrid thing to look at, her purplish bruises, and I felt shame that I hadn't been more delicate, hadn't even watched for such a thing, hadn't looked for anything but the age-old juiciness, and for all the rest, what did I care? I held her arms. I kissed these places, and I could see where needles had made holes in her, and I could see where bandages had been ripped from her, and all the fleece was gone. "Rachel, you are suffering, and I've made this worse for you," I said. "Let me get for you what you need. Send me. Tell me. I can get anything in the world for you, Rachel.
That's my nature. Do you have doctors of great skill? Only tell me who they are. I'll be lost in the winds if I roam searching for doctors and magicians. Guide me. Send me. Send me now for whatever it is.
No.
I studied her silent face. Her smile had not changed. She seemed half asleep. I realized she was singing or humming with her lips closed. Her hands were too cold. I sighed. This was the agony that comes with loving. This was just as fresh as if it had never happened to me before. This was just as hurtful and cruel as if I were breathing and young.
Don't worry, she whispered.
All the best doctors in the world have done their damnedest to cure Gregory Belkin's wife. Besides, I want to...
be with Esther?
Yes. Do you think I will be?
Yes, I do, I said. I saw her go up in a pure light. I wanted to add, one way or another, you'll be with her. But I didn't add it. I didn't know whether she believed we were all tiny flames that went back into God, or that we had a paradise where we could kiss and hold each other. As for me, I believed we had a paradise, and I had a dim memory of flying high once, to the very heights, and of gentle spirits up there concealing something from me. I lay back. I had been so sure I wanted to die. And now the flame of life that blazed still in her, melting her like a candle, seemed utterly precious to me. I wanted to try to cure her. I looked at her and tried to see all the workings of her, each thing connected to the next thing, and all bound with veins like woven gold thread. I did lay my hands on her, and I did pray. I let my hair rest on her face. I prayed in my heart to all the gods. She stirred.
"What did you say, Azrael?" she said.
She uttered some words. At first I didn't understand them. Then I realized it was Yiddish she was speaking.
"Were you speaking Hebrew?" she asked me.
"Just praying, my darling," I said. "Think nothing of it." She took a deep breath and laid her hand on my chest, as if the very act of lifting her hand and setting it down exhausted her. I put my hand over hers. Too cold, her little hands. I made a heat for us both.
"You're really staying with me, aren't you?"
"Why does that surprise you?" I asked.
"I don't know. Because people try to get away from you when they know you're really dying. Those bad nights, when I was at my worst, the doctors didn't come. The nurses stayed away. Even Gregory wouldn't come. The crisis would pass, and then they would all come. And you... you are staying with me. Doesn't the air smell good? And the light? Just the light of the night sky.
It's beautiful. A foreshadowing of paradise." She laughed a little laugh.
"I'm ready to be nothing," she said.
What could I say? Somewhere a bell rang. It throbbed. I sat up. I didn't like it. I was staring into the garden at the big red flowers, like trumpets, and realized for the first time that there were dim electric lights there on these flowers. Everything was perfect. There came the bell again.
"Don't answer it," she said. She was damp all over. "Look," she said. "Stop him. You stop the church. He's what we call a charismatic leader. He's evil. Laboratories, I don't like it. And these cults have killed people, have killed their own members."
"I know," I said. "It was always that way. Always."
"But Nathan is so innocent," she said. "I can remember his voice, it was beautiful. And I thought of what Esther had said, that it was like seeing the man Gregory could have been. That's what the voice was like.
I'll find him and make sure he is safe, I said. I'll find out what he knows, what he saw.
The old man, is he so terrible?
Holy and old, I said. I shrugged. She laughed a sweet, delighted laugh. It was wondrous to hear it. I bent down and kissed her lips. They were dry. I gave her some more water, holding her head up so she could drink. She lay back. She looked at me, and only gradually did I realize that her expression meant nothing. It was only a mask for her pain. The pain was in her lungs and in her heart and in her bones. The pain was all through her. The soothing drugs she'd taken before she left New York were gone out of her body. Her heart was faint. I cradled her hands in mine. There came that noise again, the bell ringing, the alarm buzzing. And this time there was more than one. I heard the noise of a motor. It came from the elevator shaft.
"Ignore it," she said. "They can't get in."
She pushed at the covers with her hands.
"What is it?" I asked.
"Help me. Help me get up. Get my heavier robe for me, the heavy silk. Please."
I got the robe, the one to which she pointed, and she put it on. She stood trembling beneath the weight of the ornate robe. There was a huge noise outside the main door.
"Are you sure they can't get in?"
"You don't have to fear, do you?" she asked.
"No, not at all, but I don't want them—"
"I know. Ruining my death," she said.
"Yes."
She was completely white.
"You're going to fall down."
"I know," she said.
"But I intend to fall where I want to fall. Help me out there. I want to look at the ocean."
I picked her up and carried her out the doors to the balcony. This was due east. The doors faced not the bay, but the true sea. I realized it was the same sea that washed the banks of Europe, the shores of ruined Greek cities, the sands of Alexandria. A pounding noise came from behind us. I turned around. It was coming from within the elevator. There were people in the car of the elevator, but the doors were locked. The breeze ripped across the broad terrace. Under my feet, the tiles felt cool. She seemed to love it, putting her head against my shoulder, looking out over the dark sea. A great ship hung with lights glided by just short of the horizon, and above the clouds made their spectacle. I cuddled her and held her, and started to pick her up.
"No, let me stand," she said.
She tugged herself gently free of me and put her hands on the high stone railing. She looked down. I saw a garden far down there, immaculate and full of trees and bright lights. Egyptian lilies galore, and large fan-like plants all waving just a little in the breeze.
"It's empty down there, isn't it?" she asked.
"What?"
"The garden. It's so private.
Only the flowers beneath us and beyond, the sea."
"Yes," I said.
The elevator door was being forced open.
"Remember what I said," she said. "You can't go wrong killing him. I mean it. He'll try to seduce you, or destroy you, or use you in some way. You can bet he is already thinking in those terms, how best to use you."
"I understand him perfectly," I said. "Don't worry. I will do what is right. Who knows? Maybe I will teach him right and wrong. Maybe I know what they are. Maybe I'll save his soul." I laughed. "That would be lovely."
"Yes, it would," she said. "But you're craving life, craving it. Which means you can be lured by him with all his fiery life, the same way you were lured by mine."
"Never, I told you. I'll put it right.
All of it. Put it all to right."
Several men had just broken through the front door with a clumsy pounding noise. I heard the wood splinter. She sighed.
Maybe Esther did call you down.
Maybe she did, she said.
My angel.
I kissed her. The men were blundering into the room behind us. I didn't have to look at them to know they were there. They stopped short. There was a rumble of urgent voices. Then Gregory's voice carried. Rachel, thank God you're all right. I turned and I saw him, and he saw me, and he looked hard and determined and cold. Let my wife go, he said. Liar. He was blazing with anger, and anger made him evil. Anger took away his charm. I suppose it had done that to mine before. And I realized slowly, as I stood there, that I loved again and didn't hate. I loved Esther, and I loved Rachel. I didn't hate even him.
Go to the door and stand between us, Rachel said. Do that for me, please.
She kissed me on the cheek.
Do that, my angel.
I obeyed. I put my hand up on the steel frame. You can't pass, I said. Gregory roared. He let out a terrible roar, a roar from the soul, and the whole company of men rushed towards me. I turned around as they buffeted my shoulders, passing me. But I knew already what had made them cry out. She had jumped. I went to the railing, pushing them aside, and I looked down into the garden, and I saw her tiny, empty shell of a body. The light hovered around her. Oh God, take her, please, I prayed in my ancient tongue. Then the light blazed and went straight up, and for a moment it seemed that lightning lashed the southern sky, exploded behind the clouds, but it was only her passing. She'd gone up, and for 1 second, perhaps, I'd seen the door of heaven. The garden held nothing but its bed of Egyptian flowers and her empty flesh, her face unhurt, intact, staring blindly upward. Go up, Rachel. Please, Esther, take her up the ladder. I deliberately envisioned the ladder, the stairway, replete with all the hanging remnants of memory. Gregory cried in agony. Men took hold of me by the arms. Gregory screamed and cried and sobbed, and there was no artifice to it. The man stared down at her and roared in pain and hit the railing with his fists.
Rachel! Rachel! Rachel!
I shook off the hands of the men. They fell backwards, stunned by the strength of it, and not knowing what to do, seemingly embarrassed by the figure of Gregory roaring in grief. Suddenly there was havoc all around me. More men had come. Poor Richie had come. And Gregory wailed and wailed and leaned over the railing. He was davening, bowing like a Hebrew and crying out in Yiddish. I shoved off the men again, hurling some of them to the end of the terrace. I pushed and I pushed at them till they simply backed off. I said to Gregory, "You really loved her, didn't you?" He turned and looked at me, and tried to speak, but he was choked with grief.
"She was my queen of Sheba," he said. "She was my queen."
And then he wailed again and said the same prayers. "I'm leaving you now," I said, "with all your armed men." A crowd was climbing up the slope of the garden below. Men with flashlights shone them on her dead face. Then I went up and up. Where would I go? What would I do? It was time to walk on my own. I looked back once at the tiny men down on the terrace, confounded now by my disappearance. Gregory had actually collapsed and sat down rocking, holding his head. Then I went high, so high that the joyous spirits were there, and it seemed as I flew north that they stared at me with great interest. I knew what I had to do first of all. Find Nathan. Chapter 22.
By the time I reached New York, the need for sleep was weighing me down. I would have to give in to it before further explorations. But I was fiercely worried about Nathan. Before taking on a body, I prowled invisible all through the temple of the mind. Just as I expected, there was much chemical research being done there, and there were numerous restricted areas, and there were people working in the night in the strange rubbery orange plastic suits I had seen. And these suits seemed to be filled with air. These suited beings peered through their helmets as they worked with chemicals which they obviously did not mean to breathe or touch. They were loading these into what seemed very lightweight plastic cartridges. I studied everything else that was going on. In an antiseptic laboratory, my bones lay on a hard table being studied by the evil mastermind doctor, the thin one with the bottle black hair. He had no hint of my invisible presence as I circled him. I could not make out his notes. I felt nothing for the bones, except the desire to destroy them so that I could never be driven back into them again. But I might die if that happened. It was much too soon for such a risk. Other parts of the building were obviously communication centers. There were people watching monitors, speaking on phones and working with maps. There were great electrified maps of the world on the wall, filled with pinpoints of light. There was a great air of urgency and commotion among these night workers. All spoke in a completely guarded way, as if they thought they were being monitored by enemies, and their statements were maddeningly vague. "We have to hurry. This is going to be glorious. This has to be loaded by 4 a.m. Everything at Point 17 is perfectly in line." I could not make something sensible or sophisticated out of what they said. I managed to discover from one slip of the tongue that the project they all shared was called Last Days. Last Days. All I saw alarmed me and repelled me. I suspected the chemicals in the canisters were filoviruses, or some other lethal agent only recently discovered through technology, and the entire temple stank of murder. I passed many empty floors, many sleeping dormitories filled with young minders, and a huge chapel where minders prayed silently like contemplative monks, on their knees with their hands pressed to their foreheads. The image over the altar was a great brain, the mind of God, I presume. It was a mere outline in gold. It was strangely uninspiring. It looked anatomical and bizarre. I passed rooms where men slept alone in dimness. In one room was a man covered up and bandaged, with a nurse in attendance. In other chambers there were other sick people, swathed in sheeting, hooked to gleaming tubes connected to tiny computers. Many solitary rooms contained sleeping members of the church. Some were so luxurious as to rival Gregory's rooms. They had floors of marble tile and gilded furniture. They had sumptuous bathrooms with great square tubs. I had many unanswered questions about what I saw in the building, and could have spent much more time. But now I had to go on to Brooklyn. I felt I could see what was happening. Surely Nathan was in danger. It was 2 a.m. Invisible, I passed into the Rebbe's house and found him sound asleep in his bed. But he woke the minute I entered the room. He knew I was there. He was at once alarmed and climbed out of the bed. I simply went very far away from the house. There was no time to search for Nathan or to look for more sympathetic members of the family. Besides, I was growing more tired by the minute. I couldn't dare retreat to the bones. In fact, I had no intention of ever retreating to them again, not the way that I felt now, and I feared my weakness in sleep, that I might be called back or dissolved by Gregory, or even somehow by the Rebbe. I went back into Manhattan, found a lake in the middle of Central Park, not very far at all from the huge Temple of the Mind.
Indeed, I could see all its lighted windows. I took form as a man, dressed myself in the finest garb I could conceive of. Red velvet suit, fine linen shirt, all manner of exotic gold embellishments. And then I drank huge amounts of water from the lake. I knelt and drank it in handfuls. I was filled with water, and felt very powerful. I lay down on the grass under a tree to rest, in the open, telling my body to hold firm and to wake if there was any natural or supernatural assault on it. I told it it must answer no one's call but my own. When I woke, it was 8 o'clock in the morning by the city's clocks, and I was whole, intact, with my clothes, and I was rested. Just as I supposed, I had appeared far too strange for prowling mortal men to attack, and far too puzzling to be disturbed by beggars. Whatever the case, I was strong and unharmed in my velvet suit and shining black shoes. I had survived the hours of sleep in material form, outside the bones, and this was another triumph. I danced for joy on the grass for a few minutes, then brushed off the clothes, dissolved with the requisite enchantments, and reformed, velvet-clad, bearded, and free of bits of grass and dirt in the living room of the Rebbe's house. I did not want the beard, but the beard and mustache came as they had before. And maybe they'd even been there when I woke. In fact, I'm sure they had. They had been there all along. They wanted to be there. Very well. The house was modern, cramped, made of many smallish rooms. It struck me as most remarkable how conventional this house was. It was filled with rather ordinary furniture, none of it ugly or beautiful, comfortable and well lighted. Immediately people waiting in the parlor stared at me and began to whisper. A man approached, and in Yiddish I said I had to see Nathan immediately. I realized I didn't know Nathan's real last name, or even if they called him Nathan here. Obviously his last name wasn't Belkin. Belkin was a made-up name of Gregory. I said in Yiddish that it was a matter of life and death that I see Nathan. The Rebbe flung open the doors of his study. He was in a fury. Two elderly women stood with him, and two young men, all of these people Hasidim. The women wigged to cover their natural hair, the young men with locks and silk suits. There was no one about who was not Hasidim. The Rebbe's face was trembling with outrage. He began to try to exorcise me from the house, and I stood firm and put up my hand. "I have to speak to Nathan," I said in Yiddish. "Nathan could be in danger. Gregory is a dangerous man. I have to speak to Nathan. I won't leave here until I find him. Perhaps his is a compassionate and fearless heart, and he will hear me. Whatever the case, I will speak to him in love. Perhaps Nathan walks with God, and if I save him, so shall I." Everyone fell silent. Then the men bid the women to go, which they did, and they called several old men from the parlor, and they pointed for me to go into the Rebbe's study. I was now among an assemblage of elders. One of these men took a piece of white chalk and drew a circle on the carpet, and told me to stand in it. I said, "No. I am here to love, to avert harm. I am here having loved two people who are now dead. I learned love from them. I will not be the servant of the bones. I will do no evil. I will not be driven any longer by anger, hatred, or bitterness. And I will not be confined by you and your magic to that circle. I am too strong for that circle. It means nothing to me. The love of Nathan is what calls me now." The Rebbe sank down at his desk, a rather large, formal one compared to his desk in the basement, where I had first seen him. He seemed in despair. "Rachel Belkin is dead," I told him in Yiddish. "She took her own life."
"The news says you took her life," said the Rebbe in Yiddish.
The other men murmured, nodding.
A very, very old man, balding and thin with a head like a skull covered in black silk, came forward and looked into my eyes.
"We don't watch television. We don't do it. But the news spread fast that you killed her and you killed her daughter."
"That is a lie," I said. "Esther Belkin met Nathan, Gregory's brother, in the Diamond District. She bought a necklace from him. I believe Gregory Belkin had her murdered because she knew of his family, and in particular of his twin brother. Nathan is in danger." They all stood motionless. I couldn't predict what was going to happen. I knew I made a strange sight in the dark red velvet with so much gold ornament on the cuffs and with my dark hair and long beard, but so did they make a strange sight, all of them bearded and wearing hats, either small or large-brimmed, and in long black silk suits all their own style. They gradually formed a circle around me. They began to hurl questions at me. At first I didn't realize what this was. Then it became clear that it was a test. The first question was, could I quote from this or that book of the Torah? They used letters and names I understood completely. I answered all their questions, throwing out the quotations first in Hebrew and then in Greek, and then, sometimes, to really startle them, in older Aramaic.
"Name the prophets," they said.
I did, including Enoch, who had been a prophet in my time in Babylon, whom they didn't know. They were shocked at this.
"Babylon?"
"I can't remember," I said. "I have to stop Gregory Belkin from hurting his brother Nathan. I'm convinced he killed Esther because she met Nathan and knew of Nathan. And there are other suspicious things." Now they began to question me on the Talmud. What were the mitzvot? I told them there were 613, and they were laws or rules in general concerned with attitude, what one does, good behavior, and what one says. The questions went on and on. They had to do with ritual and cleanliness, and what is forbidden, and with the heretic rabbis, and with the Kabbalah. I answered everything rapidly, lapsing into Aramaic over and over, then coming back to Yiddish. When I quoted from the Septuagint, I used the Greek. I referred sometimes to the Babylonian Talmud and sometimes to the Old Jerusalem Talmud. I answered all questions about sacred numbers, and the points of discussion became finer and finer. It seemed each man was trying to outdo the other with the delicacy of his question. Finally, I became impatient. "Do you realize while we carry on like this, as if we were in the yeshiva, that Nathan may be in danger? What is Nathan's name among you? Help me save Nathan in the name of God."
"Nathan is gone," said the Rebbe. "He is far, far away, where Gregory cannot find him. He is safe in the Lord's city."
"How do you know he's safe?"
"The day after the death of Esther, he left here for Israel. Gregory cannot find him there. Gregory could never track him down."
"The day after... You mean, then, the day before you first saw me?"
"Yes. If you aren't a Dybbuk, what are you?"
"I don't know. What I want to be is an angel, and that is what I intend to be. And God will judge whether I have done his will. What made Nathan go to Israel?" The old men looked at the Rebbe, obviously confused. The Rebbe said that he wasn't sure why Nathan wanted to take the trip just then, but it seemed in his grief for Esther, Nathan was eager to go and said something about doing his yearly work early in Israel. His work had to do with copies of the Torah, which he would bring back. Routine.
"Can you reach him?" I said. "Why should we tell you more?" said the Rebbe. "He's safe from Gregory."
"I don't think so," I said. "Now that you are all here, I want you to answer. Did any of you call upon the servant of the bones? Did Nathan?" They all shook their heads and looked at the Rebbe.
"Nathan would never do such an unholy thing."
"Am I unholy?" I lifted my hands. "Come," I said, "I invite you. Try to exorcise me. Try in the name of the Lord God of hosts.
I'll stand here firm in my love for Nathan and for Esther and Rachel Belkin. I want to avert harm. I will stand firm. Go on, give me your abracadabra Kabbalah magic."
This roused them all to whispering and murmuring, and the Rebbe, who was still furious, did begin a loud chant to exorcise me. And then all the men joined in, and I watched them, feeling nothing, not letting any anger come to the fore, only feeling love for them, and thinking with love of my master Samuel, and how I had hated him for something perhaps that was only human. I couldn't remember it. I remembered Babylon. I remembered the prophet Enoch, but each time sadness or hate or bitterness came to me, I pushed it away and thought of love. Love profane, love sacred, love of the good. I still could not recall Zervan distinctly, only the feeling, but I quoted him now out loud as best I could. Each time it seemed I used new words, but it was the same quote. "The purpose of life is to love and to increase our knowledge of the intricacies of creation. Kindness is the way of God." They kept up the exorcism, and I searched my mind, closing my eyes, and sought for the proper words, calling to the world to yield to me the proper words that would quiet them, just the way that it yielded to me the clothing I wore, or the skin that appeared human. Then I saw the words. I saw the room. I didn't know where it was then. Now I realize that it was the scriptorium in my father's house. All I knew was that it was familiar, and I began to sing the words, as I had sung them long ago, with the harp on my knee, as I had written them over and over. I sang them now in the ancient tongue in which I learned them, loudly and with rhythm, rocking as I sang. "I will love thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock, and my fortress, and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my buckler, and the horn of my salvation, and my high tower. The sorrows of death compassed me, and the floods of ungodly men made me afraid. The sorrows of hell compassed me about. The snares of death prevented me. In my distress I called upon the Lord, and cried unto my God. He heard my voice." This silenced them. They stood staring in wonder, not afraid and not full of hate. Even the Rebbe's soul was stilled and had lost its hate. I spoke in Aramaic. "I forgive those who made of me a demon, whoever they were, and to whatever purpose. Learning to love from Esther and Rachel, I come in love and to love Nathan and to love God. To love is to know love, and that is to love God. Amen." The old man looked suspicious suddenly. But it was not of me. He looked at the telephone on his desk. Then he glanced at me. The very old one said in Hebrew, "So here was a demon who would be an angel? Is such a thing possible?" The Rebbe didn't answer. Then suddenly the Rebbe picked up the phone and punched in a long series of numbers, too long for me to follow or remember. And then he began to talk in Yiddish. He asked if Nathan was there. Had Nathan arrived safely? He assumed that someone would have called had Nathan not arrived, but he wanted to speak to his grandson. Then shock came over his face. The room was silent. All the men looked at him and seemed to know what he was thinking. The Rebbe spoke into the phone in Yiddish. "He didn't tell you that he was coming? You have not heard from him one single word?" The old men were distressed. So was I. "He's not there," I said. "He's not there." The old man went over all the details with those at the other end of the line. They knew nothing about Nathan coming to Israel. Last they heard, Nathan would come at his regular time later in the year. All was in readiness for Nathan's regular visit. They had received no calls from Nathan about an early visit. The Rebbe put down the phone. "Don't tell Sarah," he said, with his hand raised. All the others nodded. He then told the youngest of the men to go for Sarah. "I'll speak with Sarah," Sarah came into the room, a modest and humble woman, very beautiful, her natural hair covered by an ugly brown wig. She had narrow, almond-shaped eyes and a lovely, soft mouth. She emanated kindness, and when she glanced at me shyly, she made no judgment. She looked at the Rebbe.
"Your husband has called you since he left?"
She said no.
"You went with him and Jacob and Joseph to the plain?"
She said no. Silence. She looked at me and then looked down. "Please forgive me," I said. "But did Nathan tell you he was going to Israel?" She said yes, and that a car had come for him, from a rich friend in the city to take him, and he had said he would be back very soon. "Did he tell you who this friend was?" I asked. "Please tell me, Sarah, please." She seemed utterly reassured, and something inside her was suddenly unlocked. I saw in her eyes the same gentleness that I had seen in the girl on the street in the southern city, and in Esther herself, and in Rachel, the pure gentleness of women, which is wholly different from the pure gentleness of men. "Maybe this is what happens when you love, really love," I thought. "People love you in return." I felt so free of hatred and anger suddenly that I shivered, but I implored her with my eyes to speak. She looked shaken, and then she glanced at the Rebbe, and bowed her head and blushed. She was about to cry. "He had with him her diamond necklace," she said. "The necklace of his brother's daughter, Esther Belkin. He was taking it to his brother." She began to cry. "When he had heard of the necklace being stolen," she said, "when he heard this tale, he knew it wasn't true. He had the necklace. Esther Belkin had given it to him for mending." She swallowed her tears and continued. "Rebbe, he didn't want anyone to be angry. He called his brother to tell him. He said his brother was crying. The car came to take him to his brother so that he might restore the necklace to him which had been Esther's. And then his brother wanted Nathan to come with him to Israel, that they stand together at the Wailing Wall. Nathan promised me that when he had comforted his brother he would return. Perhaps, he said, he could bring his brother back home."
"Ah, of course," I said. "Quiet," said the Rebbe. "Sarah, don't be sorry or sad. Don't worry. I'm not angry that he went with his brother. He went in love, with good intentions."
"He did, Rebbe," she said, "he did."
"Leave this to us."
"I'm so sorry, Rebbe, but he loved his brother and was so stricken with grief for the girl. He said the girl would one day have come to us and would have wanted to be one of us. He was sure of it. He had seen it in her eyes."
"I see, Sarah. Don't think any more about it. Go out now."
She turned her head, still crying, glanced back at me once, and then left the room. I felt so sorry for her, so very sorry. She knew something was wrong, but she had no idea what was wrong, how bad it was. She was loving by nature. Maybe Nathan was, too. Very likely so, as Rachel and Esther had said he was. "It's just as I thought," I said. The old man waited on me in silence. "Gregory used the necklace to lure Nathan to him. Gregory published that stupid story of the stolen necklace so that Nathan would call him, and he could persuade Nathan to meet with him and stay with him. Nathan prepared you for his prolonged absence. Gregory put him up to this. I will do everything in my power to see that Nathan is returned unharmed.
I can't stay with you now. Will you give me your blessing, all of you?
I won't linger begging for it, but if you want to give it, I will receive it with love in the name of the Lord. My name is Azrael." They cried out, throwing up their hands and backing away. It was the fear of knowing the name of a spirit, though I hadn't expected such alarm at this point. I put my hands to my temples and thought again. "Yield to me the words. Yield to me the words. I know my name is not evil." Then I declared, "I was named Azrael by my father when I was circumcised in our own house of prayer at Babylon. We were the last tribes taken hostage out of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar.
The name was good enough for God and for the tribe and for my father. Nabonidus was king, and we practiced our faith in peace under his rule. We sang the Lord's song in that strange land every day.
A great flush of energy passed through me, but again the memory lacked substance, color. I knew only that what I said was true, and that if I could solve this blasted mystery, this horror, then perhaps in time I could recall other things, just as I had recalled this, and all my past would come to me. Not in hatred, but in love. I was now fascinated by love. No doubt of it. They fell to murmuring. It is his Hebrew name. It is his human name. It is his own name blessed by God. And some arguing that to know my name only gave them power over me, and others whispered that I was an angel. Then, with a nod from the Rebbe, they all gave me their blessings. I felt nothing, but at least I didn't dislike them any more. I loved them and saw them for what they were, and feared all the more for Nathan.
"But what is Gregory doing?" the Rebbe whispered, more to himself than to me.
"I don't know," I admitted again. "But Nathan is an identical twin, is he not? And your grandson Gregory would be the Messiah, would he not? He would change the whole world." The old man was perplexed and horrified. I asked, "If I need you, for Nathan's sake, for the sake of the love of all God's creatures, will you come?"
"Yes," said the Rebbe.
I was about to walk out of the room, but I decided, for obvious reasons, that it was best to vanish. I did so slowly, so as to amaze them, growing transparent, rising, extending my arms, then vanishing altogether. I don't think they saw the tiny bits of moisture all through the air. They probably only felt the coolness, and then the heat when a spirit vanishes. I left them staring solemnly at the place where I'd stood. I wanted desperately to comfort Sarah, whom I saw crying at the kitchen table, but there was no way, no time. I went up higher and higher. "Gregory," I said. And I set my destination to that place where the Master of the Bones might be, his temple. To search, as a spirit, for Nathan was impossible. I had never laid eyes on him, caught his scent, seen or touched him or his garments. He might have been sleeping in one of those rooms in the temple which I roamed invisible the night before. But I had not lingered on faces. There had been hundreds of faces. "Go to Gregory. The danger to Nathan was with his brother, and that was where I had to be now. I had one comforting thought. Whatever was in store for Nathan had probably not transpired yet. On the other hand, the people in the temple had been working full speed on the project called the Last Days." Chapter 23. A huge mob surrounded the Temple of the Mind. I came down into it invisible, amid the cameras and the radio people, and understood that Gregory Belkin was to appear to make a momentous statement at 6 p.m. or before, and that he knew the identity of his enemies and the enemies of the temple. He intended to name his terrorist enemies and try to prevent their new plan of destruction. The crowd spilled out, blocking Fifth Avenue, and many of the minders, virtually pushed away by the press, were in the park praying. I went up and into the building and found Gregory seated in a huge room with five men, amid the big electric maps and numerous monitors, and he was hard at work going over the final directions. The room itself was soundproof, and before I made myself visible I saw that no camera monitored the room itself. All monitors revealed the outside, and the walls in the rooms didn't have ears either. As I descended, Gregory spoke. "Nothing will happen until 2 hours after I'm declared officially dead," he said. And these words immediately galvanized me. I appeared in my full Babylonian robes of blue velvet and gold, and my long hair and beard, and I snatched him up from the chair. The men raced at me, and I threw them back. Through another door came a small group of heavily armed soldiers. Someone fired a gun. Gregory shouted, "No! No!" This little cadre of ruthless guards surrounded me with powerful modern guns, the kind that fix you in a beam of light before they shoot you. All these men had the look of killers. As for those who had been gathered at the table, they were the milder sort, though equally as serious, and they included the mastermind doctor. And they reeked of resentment and suspicion and absolute desperation that I had interrupted them. "No, be calm," said Gregory. "This is inevitable, and this will not stop us. This is an angel sent from God to help us." "Is that so?" I said. "What have you done with your brother? If you don't talk the truth to me, I'll tear you limb from limb, and all these men will die with you. That's the only alternative you give me. What is this about your official death? Talk now, or I will destroy." Gregory sighed, and then he told the other men to go. "Everything will go as planned. Only this angel needs to know the scope of his power," he said. "Go on, man your desks in the building, and see that my brother is comfortable and not afraid. Everything will be glorious. We are in the time of miracles. This creature you see here is a miracle from God. Say nothing to anyone." The men at the table left with amazing speed, but the soldiers took a little more firm persuading from him that he knew what he was doing. I flung him back down in his chair. "You lying monster," I said. "How could you tell the world I killed your wife and your daughter? Tell me now where Nathan is. Tell me now what you mean to do." I scanned the monitors all along the tops of the walls. They covered entryways, the lobby, elevators that were not in operation. I could see nothing but empty space in most, and guards passing. The maps were dazzling and filled with pulsing neon colors, countries done in scarlet and yellow, and rivers drawn in light like lightning. But there was no time to admire these things. "Haven't you guessed it, clever spirit?" he said. He smiled up at me. "How glad I am to see you. What took you so long? I need you, and time is running out." "I know you're going to do something with your brother," I said. "Put him in your place to be killed, so that you can rise from the dead. That much is easy to figure, and 6 is the hour you've marked for it." 6 or before, what does that mean? I want your brother now, safe and in my arms, to be taken back to his people." "No, you don't, Azrael," he said with great reasonableness, his confidence flaring up in him like an unquenchable fire. "Sit down and let me tell you what is to happen. You cannot imagine the beauty of it, and Nathan will suffer no pain. He is sedated and hardly knows what will happen to him." "I'm sure he is," I said with great contempt. And a memory came back to me of people giving me something to drink and saying, "You will not suffer." They were painting gold on my skin. "If you kill me," Gregory said, "you will change nothing. The plan goes into operation after my death. If you want me to die before 6 o'clock, then you will simply move up the time of the last days. Everything is set into motion. Only I can stop it. You'd be a fool to kill me." He gestured for me to sit down. "This room is soundproof. It has no security monitor," he said. "What we say here is private, utterly. And I want your attention and your sympathy." "The soldiers?" I pressed a button here under the table. "They won't come in again. But what I tell you must be secret, secret from all the world. You must be one of us when we leave this room. We have to leave it together." "You're dreaming." "No. You lack vision, spirit. You always have. You've spent too many centuries a slave. Now, only in my time have you known your full strength. Admit it. The doctors found living seed in my wife. You've lost your glaze-eyed, confused look, spirit. My wife taught you how to be a man." I said nothing. But I did have a strong sense of something, that I couldn't simply solve this by chopping him up like the Gordian knot. "Right you are," he said. "Sit down and listen to me." I took the first chair to his left. He picked up a small, multi-buttoned remote control device. I placed my hand on it. "It controls the monitors, nothing more. Most are security. Only 2 have film in them.
Look directly up there over the central map. At once, two of the screens began to fill with still shots, frozen for about 2 seconds each, of people who were starving, or the dead, battlefields, bombed-out buildings, trash heaps. I recognized that these photos were a steady panorama from all over the world. I could see the Mayan temples in one picture of gathered villagers. In another, I saw ruins I knew to be in Cambodia. He watched these almost serenely, as if he'd forgotten my presence or took me utterly for granted. "Assure me nothing will happen to Nathan," I said, "as we talk." "I assure you," he said, "nothing will happen, until 6 o'clock, and even then it depends on my signal. But I should let you know, Angelic One, you have no bargaining power."
"Oh?"
As he turned and smiled graciously at me, he was now preening and full of happiness. "I've waited so long for this to come," he said, "and to think that you arrived in the midst of it. I do think God sent you as an answer to the sacrifice of Esther. I myself didn't see the symmetry of it or the genius until later. I offered up Esther, whom I loved, truly loved, and you came through the break from the heavens." He seemed perfectly sincere. "I have not been in heaven," I said. "Where is Nathan?" "First," he said, "let us think intelligently. If you should lose your angelic temper and kill me, you'll only trigger the plan automatically. If you destroy this building, you'll trigger the plan automatically. If you want any chance of understanding, acceptance, or modification, you need me. And hear me out." "All right," I said. "But you do plan to kill Nathan at 6 o'clock. You admit it. And you could do it before. That's why you put him in the hospital under your name, to create DNA evidence and dental evidence to identify Nathan as you, so that your death would be certified, didn't you?" He didn't seem at all happy to hear this much figuring. "That's a crude version of what I accomplished," he said. "But look, the world is at stake, Azrael, the world itself. Dear God, you must be my divine witness." "Don't get romantic, Gregory. Tell me the plan. Somewhere else you have DNA documents that will be used to cleverly replace Nathan Set, and these documents will confirm you when you have risen. You have many people involved in erasing and moving data." "I'm beginning to love your intelligence," he said. "Now really use it. This is for the world itself. It's for that we do what we do. And you cannot prevent what will happen, and you must keep it in your mind that when the last days come, and they will begin sometime before midnight this night, you will need me. You will need me desperately, just as everyone alive and meant to live will need me. Otherwise only disaster can follow upon disaster."
"Okay, what is this last days? What's to happen?"
"You're going to have him assassinated. Then what? Appear to rise from the dead?"
"In 3 days," he said. "Isn't that the way the other Messiah did it?" He was cooler. 3 days. Blurry, horrid images filled with lions, a loathsome swarm of bees dancing. I shivered and fought it off. I saw the cross of Christ. I saw the risen Christ in paintings old and new. I heard Christian words in Greek and Latin.
"I'm eager to have you understand this," he said. "You know, it's occurred to me several times that you are the only one who will fully appreciate this."
"And why is that?"
"Azrael, nobody else alive has my courage. No one. It takes courage to kill. You know it does. You know time and the world, and have probably witnessed war, starvation, injustice. But first, allow me to caution you. If you don't hear me out, if you decide that my death is appropriate, and that you don't care what happens to the world, there's the question of the bones."
"Yes?"
"They are in a kiln in this building, and a word from me will roast them and melt them into running liquid. Oh, and I should tell you the results of our tests on them, shouldn't I?"
"If you want to waste the time.
I'd rather hear about the last days."
Don't you want to know what's inside your bones?"
"I know. My bones."
He shook his head and smiled.
"No more," he said. "The human bone is almost entirely devoured by the metals in which it was encased. There is very little, if anything, left. Which means, I think, that as soon as the metal is heated, it will easily incinerate and obliterate any trace of the human remaining."
"That's what it means to you?" I smiled. "How amusing. Your test results have an entirely different meaning for me. Did you find enough there to do your DNA magic?"
He shook his head.
"There's almost nothing left."
"That's good news. But go on."
He studied me most intensely. He reached out to take my hand, which I more or less allowed. All his charm was in play now, and his eyes had the depth of greatness and the sincerity of greatness. Very alluring. Rachel had warned me of this. But I loathed him. For Esther and Nathan alone, as if all the world didn't matter, or as if to mourn them was to mourn all injustice. "Azrael, this is a dream of unparalleled greatness. It has harshness in it and death, but so did the conquests of Alexander. So did the conquests of Constantine. You know they did. You know the land of Egypt lived in peace for 2,000 years because of harshness and the willingness to kill. You know or remember those long times of peace. The peace of Alexander, and after him the Pax Romana. Tell me the plan." He pointed to the big map on the wall, the map of the world that was filled with pinpoints of light. The pinpoints were red and blue mostly, though some were yellow. They were in stark contrast to the lights of the map, but I saw now much drawing and marking on the map, much detail. "Those are my headquarters throughout the world," he said. "Those are my temples, my so-called resorts, my so-called business offices, airports, islands."
"God, why does ambition come to such a man?" I said. "Think of the good you could do, you blithering moral idiot."
He laughed sincerely and like a child.
"But that's just it, my tactless and impulsive one. I am a moral genius."
He pointed to the maps.
"They are ready within 2 hours of confirmation of my death to destroy 2/3 of the world's population completely. Now, before you object, let me explain that this will be done by a phylovirus perfected here by us, which is already in place in those various temples. Don't interrupt."
He raised his hand and went on.
"It is a virus which kills within 5 minutes or less. It is airborne only as long as its host breathes, which is no more than 5 minutes. Its first immediate action is to fog the brain and to fill the victim with a feeling of peace and ecstasy."
He smiled gently, his eyes glazed suddenly, as though he were listening to grand and majestic music. "No one will suffer, Azrael, at least not more than a few moments. Oh, it is such perfection compared to the hideous, bumbling stupidity of Hitler when he bludgeoned, shot, and tormented the Jews. What a crude, cruel monster he was. A digger of graves, a ragman, a fiend who tinkered with the gold in the mouths of his millions of victims." He shrugged. "Ah, maybe it simply wasn't the time. We didn't have the technology." He resumed. "The virus will be dropped along with a lethal gas that tends to dissipate within 4 hours. These combined should kill everything living and human in the area. My planes and